Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
All right, what is Yoga Panda?
Yoga Panda is a platform that makes it easy for consumers to be able to find yoga classes near them. And we also work with local studio owners to help them acquire new customers.
This is Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. And I'm at the Hot Yoga Studio on Queen Anne Hill in Seattle. And maybe you could introduce yourself and say what it is you do.
Sure. So my name is Othman Ramouni. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Yoga Panda.
So people might go onto your app and they would punch in what?
We saw that it was important for people to find classes that match certain criteria, such as how close the studio is to them, the kind of class they're looking for, maybe the specific teacher they want to take a class with, and ultimately designed an experience through an app that makes it very easy in less than 60 seconds to find exactly the class that they want. And once they're able to find it, they can book it and pay for it directly on the app.
So you came to this from a steady corporate gig at some point pretty recently, right?
Yeah, so I spent almost 9 years at Microsoft, but it became clear to me as I continued to grow in my career that entrepreneurship was the path for me. And so after having thought about it very deeply, because it's very hard to live a very comfortable lifestyle where you're making very good money, and then to be able to say, well, the risk is worth it. This is the kind of lifestyle that I want to create for myself, and I believe that I can have more impact and really change people's lives.
Have you always been okay with the risk?
I've always been wired as an entrepreneur. I'm willing to take the extra risk, and with shows like Shark Tank and other things, it's very sexy to be an entrepreneur. People think it's this easy thing where then you can go around and pass your business card and say, you know, I'm a founder of a successful company. But what people don't see is that, you know, it takes 12-hour workdays, 16-hour workdays, 7 days a week for months and months and months. And after about, you know, 9 months of doing that and potentially not seeing the traction that you want, you start doubting yourself and you're like, well, what was I thinking? And so I think, one, you're going to make sure that you can sustain yourself financially. And number two, you got to ensure that you've got the support system in place, whether it's family, whether it's a spouse, a friend circle that ultimately gives you the support that you need when you're going through those peaks and valleys. And, you know, like those valleys can be really tough.
Are you able to tell me about one of them?
I'm a positive person, so a lot of people who meet me, they're like, oh, you know, you're full of energy. But there are times when you're sitting on your own at 3 a.m. and you're trying to solve a problem and you're like, I've put in like a week of work to try to build something because you believe that it was a great strategy that was going to allow you to gain so many new customers. And then you're sitting there and it's like, it didn't work. And so you're like, what was I thinking? And you start doubting yourself, but you just have to keep going. It's very much about being able to say, you know what? I'm going to try to learn as much as I can. I'm going to try to overcome whatever challenges. And ultimately, if we can create something that's bigger and better and that makes the world a better place. For us, a lot of our vision is to get people moving and healthier and exercising. There are another, you know, 5 people or 10 people or 1,000 people and hopefully millions of people that we can impact in that same way. And that gets you that fire inside to keep going.
Okay, time to see what kind of impact Yoga Panda has on me, a man who's done yoga 1.5 times in his life. The owner shows me the ropes. How hot are we talking about here?
It'll be about 90 degrees in there. So let's start with Warrior 2. You're going to take your right foot.
This week on Sound Effect, we're talking more about the peaks and valleys of life in a startup. What makes it so exciting and so frustrating.
There it is. Yeah, nice job. That's Warrior 2.
I feel like a warrior.
You should feel like a warrior.
It's all coming up on the show here on KPLU, so don't go away.
Yeah, well, that works too.
What did you have in mind? Sorry.
One of the things that can make startups such thrilling places to work is that there are no rules. You don't have to toil for years just to earn some real responsibilities. You kind of just jump right in. And that leads to one of the goofier perks of startup culture, getting to create your own job title. And man, a lot of tech people really run with that. Well, that struck Bridget Quigg as a little endearing and a little ridiculous. She's a writer who's worked in startups for about a decade, and she just finished up a run of her one-woman satirical show, Techlandia. She came by to share the formula for the perfect tech job title and why she finds them so funny.
People just get very, very out there and have so much fun with it, particularly I think the youngest people who wish they had more authority. Maybe they're at management level, so they just go nuts with their like assistant job.
Is that something part of what's behind this is the fact that in startups and in tech in general, you so often have young people who might be on the low end of the totem pole in other industries, all of a sudden empowered to do whatever they want?
That's absolutely the case. When you walk in the door to startup and you're fresh out of college, you are going to be in charge of something because they just need somebody to do that thing. So go for it on your title. And it's part of compensation a lot of places. It's like not only will you earn this much money, get this much stock, you get to pick your job title and it's going to be a good one. And we will say that that is your job title.
Can you think of an example of one that you tickled your fancy?
Well, I do have one friend actually who worked at Cranium early on, and his title was Content Cowboy because he was in marketing and he wrote content. Yeah, Content Cowboy. It was on his business card.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Have you had any particularly tasty ones?
I had a fear you would ask me this. So I have to admit, at one point I was moved to content strategist. So before I was what was called a web producer, which was a very common term in like the early 2000s. So my boss was like, you're going to be a content strategist now. And I didn't even get a raise. It was just like, we need you to have this title so we look cool. And I was like, ooh, that sounds really like technical and heavy. I don't know. So I added creative to the front of it.
You
so
threw
I was a
in
creative
an adjective.
Content. I threw in an adjective. I was a creative content strategist. No joke.
Did you feel any different once you got that new title than you did about your old title?
I was mostly stressed out by it because it sounded really demanding. It's like, oh, I'm a strategist. I thought I was just a writer.
You've got a really great riff on this topic in your one-woman show, Techlandia. And I'd like to play a little excerpt from
sure.
it.
You got to have two basic components, I've noticed. Number one. It needs to be impressive. Okay. Duh. Number two, it needs to be a little bit confusing. So, let's say there's someone at the company called an innovation outreach lead. Probably started yesterday, just finished college, and they're setting up appointments for the sales team. But their name is innovation outreach lead. Why not? They're leading that. Yeah. There is a pattern, I think, that is just the surefire way to make sure that you get an awesome, awesome job title, all right? It is adjective, title, adjective, thing or department. So, for example, chief manager of product creation. And you can add and just really beef it up. Chief manager of product creation, ideation, and innovation. Whoa. Holy. I've just thought of some more common job titles that I feel like we could take this pattern and kind of spice up. Store manager. Impressive, but I'm not confused. How about Supreme Ambassador for Optimized Sales Efforts? Wow. Maybe they're running a small country and a retail store.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What gave you the idea to skewer this phenomenon in that way?
It kind of came to me, the idea of job title bingo. I had a friend when I worked at a local company just recently. She was learning to code. And to practice coding, she made an app where you would get to get a bunch of words and they would mix them all up and it would just come up with job titles like Supreme Director for Educational Innovation. And then the game was you had to say what that person does. I think somewhere in my subconscious that was sitting there, and then I came up with my own version of the game.
And in your show, what comes next is an actual round of job title bingo.
Yes, we bring someone on stage who's very brave, and they have to pick up the words, right? And then I also ask them to tell me what this person does.
So you have very graciously brought in some of the ingredients of job title bingo. Do you want to describe what's on these papers here?
Sure. So we have four sections, as I talk about. And so you have like your adjectives like commanding, chief, strategic, lead. Then in this big bucket, you have things like messiah, guru, hacker, principal. And then you have a third bucket for things like content, strategy, quantified, growth. And then finally, you get things like innovation, disruption, education, leadership. So, for example, you could say supreme Admiral, because Gabriel liked that one. Supreme Admiral for innovation analysis. That would be one you could do.
So can I try a few?
Please do.
Okay. I'm going to go with advanced craftsman for cloud disruption.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I love it. Disruption is a great word. Yes, well done. People love to disrupt. That's very important.
How did that become a positive thing? So I was wondering if I could ask you to play along with something. We have some fairly, I would say vague, but you know, rather conventional titles in our industry, in radio and in audio. Things like associate producer. I don't mean that to disrespect any of our associate producers. It's just that, like, wouldn't you guys like a little spice? So I thought we'd ask Dr. Bridget to see if she could doctor up a little bit of a more grandiose title.
Gabriel, I'm glad you asked. I did some thinking about this, earlier, and I was thinking of, like, you know, chief commander of audio initiatives.
Oh.
Maybe.
Yes.
Chief maker of news audiation. Is that even a thing? I don't even know.
It is now. Aaron Hennessy, you listening? Okay. To help you out, I'd throw in a few synonyms that you can pick from here. Here's a little list.
Okay.
I don't know if that might help spark some ideas.
Oh, my gosh. It's excellent. Okay. So we're going to go with, lead minister for ear candy strategy.
Yes.
Ear candy. You win with that. That's brilliant.
That's Allie Ferguson right there.
Oh, good. Okay. So supreme craftsman for sonic wave management.
Very nice. Kevin, right. You listening?
Okay.
This is, I could probably do this all day.
I think we have a board game in the making, maybe.
So to get half serious for a second, this phenomenon seems to gesture at something real, right? I mean, it gets a little bit at what makes startup culture so simultaneously thrilling and ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's start with the thrilling part. Like what about this you think gets at what makes it really fun to work for one of these companies?
It's very true. When you enter into a startup, you don't just do one job pretty much ever. You usually have to pick up and take on projects, learn new skills all the time. And this getting a great job title kind of goes with that energy of you're going to do so much more and be so much more than you would at a large company where you are cogging the wheel. You have to get 10 approvals for everything you write. At a startup, sometimes like, hey, we got to fire up the homepage. Just come up with something and like we need it today because we're meeting with somebody tomorrow.
Yeah. And that is a really different from generations past, it seems like, where you might work for 10 years at a big company in order to claw your way up the ladder a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But then this also kind of gets at what's so kind of puffed up about startup culture and maybe, I'll say it, annoying in some cases,
sure.
Right? I mean, that's obviously what makes it funny, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think in some ways, I hate to say it, people kind of love to hate the youth a little bit on the startup culture thing because you have these people right out of college who suddenly have a tremendous amount of responsibility. The matching experience and skills, not so much.
And it seems like everybody thinks they're saving the world.
Okay, you're right. Well, that's where that disruption is such. It's funny you say disruption is a positive word because if you aren't disrupting something, what are you doing? You know, you got to disrupt an industry or disrupt a product type thing in order to matter. So everything you do has to kind of be big and amazing because you're trying to get money.
Man.
Yeah.
Bridget Quigg is a writer, and she still freelances for a lot of startups in the Seattle area and elsewhere. Her one-woman show, Techlandia, sold out its run. Are you going to run it again? Or?
I'm taking it to the Bay.
Well, we'll keep you posted at kplusoundeffect.org. Thank you, Bridget, for coming on the show.
Gabriel, thank you. It was just fun.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking startups. And as we've heard a little bit, launching a successful startup usually takes a superhuman act of will and a lot of planning. But in this next case, it sort of happened by accident. It started out not as a business, but as a high school assignment. Greta Zorn is a senior at Northwest School in Seattle, and she and her classmates Alex White and Taya Christensen were supposed to create an activism project. And they came up with a t-shirt with a drawing of a uterus.
On the front, I drew a uterus, but it's botanical, so there's flowers behind it and intertwined with it, sort of like with the fallopian tubes around there. And then underneath it says, not a political object. And that's it. Fairly straightforward, fairly simple, black and white.
How'd you get the idea to have the plants and flowers intertwining with the tubes?
From the very beginning, we knew we wanted a uterus, because that's sort of what it all comes down to. But we wanted something that people would wear is the other thing. It's one thing just to be wearing a uterus, and it's another one to have something stylistic.
How did this project begin?
It actually started as a school project. It's called the Activism Project. The only prerequisite was that you had to do something that would inspire change within the school. So some people made movie nights against bullying. There's another group of teams sold shirts about the Black Lives Matter movement. They capped the number of shirts we were allowed to buy at 60, just because the school footed the original bill. And they were very adamant that they didn't want to be in debt to like a bunch of seniors who had this wild, crazy idea.
So they footed the bill to make 60 shirts.
And then we were going to pay them back.
I see, but out of what that, you earned.
Exactly.
So you made those 60 shirts, and then what did you expect to happen?
We felt fairly certain that we could sell 60 within just the school community. You know, like having a bake sale, but instead uterus shirts.
Sure.
Yeah.
So what happened next?
So we did in a day, which was surprising to us, because we had a whole month planned to be selling them. So we sold them out in a day, and then we had a waiting list of around, I think it was 30 people, and 10 or so friends outside of school who wanted them. We just thought, okay, it'd be so much easier if we made a website for this. And, you know, the beauty of social media is that completely beyond what we were expecting. One mom posted about it, not even one of our moms, but our friend's mom posted about it. She went to an all-women's college, and her Facebook post got 3,000 shares in, I think, 2 weeks.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So what did that do for your sales? How did you guys wind up making out?
It's funny. It's all linked to just one PayPal account. And I think there's around $30,000 in it at this moment in time.
Yeah. $30,000. How many shirts have you sold?
We've sold right around 1,700 at this point in time.
So are you guys rolling in dough now? Are you loaded? Are you going to go off and buy a fancy car?
Well, I mean, we're donating all the proceeds to Planned Parenthood. So hopefully Planned Parenthood is able to make good use of what we give them.
And that was the plan all along, right?
Yeah, that was the plan from the very beginning, is we thought we were going to hopefully get, you know, $300 to them. And now it's looking quite upwards of that. So
can you talk about how the reproductive rights issues became so important to you? How did your interest in it evolve?
Alex and Teo apparently took a walk on the first day, and they turned to each other and they were like, okay, say what you're interested. 1, 2, 3, go. And both of them were very interested in reproductive rights. And then I found them sitting at a table, and I sidled over and said, I need to be a part of this. Because I think for once you become aware of the inequity involved with reproductive rights and the ridiculousness of the arguments that are being had over it, it's something that you just can't let go of.
And do you remember becoming aware of the political dimension of this and how, as you see it, these parts of your own body became a political football, political object?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I mean, I was aware of the fact that abortion was sort of being fought over my entire life. But what really drove it home was when Cecile Richards had to go testify against the Planned Parenthood sells baby parts situation. That was the first thing that really enraged me, I think. Was both the fact that it was that this heavily edited, incomplete, just ridiculous video was being taken seriously by something like Congress, and then the fact that she was able to go testify for so many hours so calmly and so well-spoken. The fact that she was both able to and did, that was inspiring.
So with T-shirts in particular, you know, people wear T-shirts often as a sort of ironic or sarcastic style statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this clearly was intended as a political statement, but are you at all concerned that people might wear it for more superficial reasons or more trivial reasons rather than actually getting behind the message that you're trying to get across?
I think the thing with our shirts is we're not asking that everyone who wears it goes out and becomes an activist in their own right. But the fact is, it's a very stigmatized discussion, and it's a discussion in which there's a lot of misinformation being spread. And I think just an abundance of people wearing shirts, you know, ironically or not, will help to change the conversation in a positive manner.
By the way, what's it like walking around your school and seeing multiple people wearing this thing that you drew?
It is the most exciting thing in the whole world. I mean, there is genuinely more than one person wearing it at any given point in time. And it's really exciting. That's almost more exciting to me as, you know, the person who drew it than the huge number of orders we've gotten throughout the country, is just being able to walk down the hall and see more than one person wearing something I made.
So what's this experience taught you about how to interact with people who don't agree with you?
One of the almost unfortunate things is that you want to be able to educate every person. And at the very beginning of the project, that was something we were doing, where we would conscientiously email back every person that sent us some sort of uninformed complaint and try to say, you know, no, that's not true. Like, let us help you understand. And then there was a line where for a few of them, we became uncomfortable answering. Didn't want to put ourselves in danger. And that's the unfortunate thing, is when you feel like there's a time where you can't respond. Because that's what the basis of this project was for us, is we wanted it to start conversations.
I feel like we've seen so many of the public conversations online around gender deteriorate into real hostility and in some cases threats and stuff like that. Have you guys experienced any of that?
No, on the bright, that is the really fantastic thing, is that the conversations we've been able to have been very productive.
Do you see this as being a longer term business? I mean, you've got a startup on your hands now. You maybe weren't expecting that. So is this something you're going to try and keep up, or are you going to just play out the string on it and move on?
Yeah, it's funny to be handed a startup by accident, you know. The funny thing is all of us have to go off to college this summer. So it's funny to be suddenly on the verge of something so exciting and so big right when you're changing plans in a big way. We're definitely moving it into the summer, though. We want to extend it as long as we can. But realistically speaking, none of us really knows what we're going to be able to do.
So you're going to wing it.
Yeah, we're going to wing it.
Greta Zorn is a senior at Northwest School, and you can learn more about her accidental startup, Uterish, and about the t-shirt she created along with her classmates Alex and Taya at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Hey, Greta, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking about startups today on the show. And it's one of the hard realities of the tech sector that women are hugely underrepresented in the highest ranks. This firm called Crunchbase looked at startups launched between 2009 and 2014, and they found that 84% had no female founders or co-founders. And at the same time, another new study, this one by a venture capital firm, looked at 300 companies and found the ones with a female founder did much better than all male-led startups. Well, that always rankled Jonathan Spezzato. He's a Seattle-based investor, and a year ago, he was in an auditorium down in Pioneer Square. The room was packed with investors at the Seattle Angel Conference, and Spezzato was giving the keynote lecture when he did something that surprised even himself.
It was pretty electric. It was a crowded room. I think there were at least a couple of hundred people there, and they were all there to hear folks talk about investing.
So this turned out to be a little bit different from a lot of other conferences and speaking engagements that you must have done, right? What happened?
Yeah. So I made a statement which was unscripted and totally unplanned, where I felt it in the moment, and I said, moving forward, I would no longer invest in any startup company unless it had a female founder or at least one female co-founder. And when I made that statement, the entire room sort of just, it was very electric. It just kind of, you know, burst out in applause. And it was very unexpected for me because I wasn't trying to make a statement.
Yeah. What prompted it?
There were a lot of female-founded startup companies that were pitching me for me to invest in them. And they were all, to a person, really great companies, really great entrepreneurs. And I became utterly confused as to why it was taking so darn long for some of them to get funded. It might take two women who started a great, you know, company of some sort, it may take them a year to raise the same amount of money as it might take, you know, two guys who recently exited Amazon, 90 days to raise the same amount of money.
Can you think of any particular examples that sort of stuck out in your mind where you were just like, what is going on here? And that made you understand that there really is a problem, maybe a structural problem.
My good friend Lisa Mackey, who is an amazing businesswoman who founded a company called Pocket Doc. So they're in the healthcare space. And I remember how frustrated she was. She was getting no traction on a concept that I thought was gosh, this is great. And she got so frustrated that at one point she asked me if I would consider being a CEO of the company instead, because I fit the profile of what investors are looking for.
So how did that play out? How did you respond to that?
Well, what I did was I said, no, Lisa, I think I shouldn't be your CEO. I think we're going in a wrong direction there. You should remain a CEO of this company. And here's what we're going to do. I will be your lead investor. And so I will go and help you to raise money. That seemed to ignite the fire, and they're doing very well now. And they've raised a couple of rounds, really, really great investors in a syndicate. Going up a notch there is Glamhive, just an incredibly cool concept where they were ahead of the game and noticing how people are taking selfies, but moreover, that they're hashtagging a lot of things in their outfits. And so they created this Instagram-like social media where they very smartly tag your outfit, right? A selfie.
Oh, so the same way Facebook finds faces, this can find brands
and
stuff
like that? Yeah, exactly. Ah. And here's the thing, right? If you see an outfit that someone's wearing in that photo and you're like, man, that's a cool shirt, you can click right through and buy it. I thought of it as something that was very, very investable. I'll say it in a safe way like that. Right? I like the concept. But time and time again, they got from a lot of male investors, you know, I just don't get it. It seems like it's a female concept. You know, maybe I have to talk to my wife about this. It makes the entrepreneur feel as though, okay, you're putting me in a box or a category that is different from any other concept that's walking in your front door. And I happen to believe as an investor that you could just assess it on its own merits.
So let's go back now to that room a year ago, the Seattle Angel Conference, where you made this pronouncement that you were only going to invest in startups with at least one female founder. You said that it got a great reaction in the room.
Yeah.
Did you have a moment, though, where you were like, what have I done? What have I got myself into?
Not at that point. It wasn't until later, one of the major news sites wrote about it, and the comments, first of all, it is the internet, but it was eye-opening to me what sort of the, some of the contrarian or opposition perspective sounded like.
Yeah. I mean, I read some of those comments much as I could stomach. I mean, there's a lot of out-and-out racism directed at you. There was a lot of just pure misogyny. Mm-hmm. But then there were a lot of people who said, well, this is no different than sex discrimination. This is sex discrimination from the other side, from a feminist point of view. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that kind of critique?
Yeah. So I do feel like that statement is confused, because I think it's not acknowledging the very unfair, an unequal and biased framework that we all operate in, right? So, yeah, if things were absolutely fair, if the last 100 years women were getting paid the same amount as men, if the last 20 years there have been as many female executives in technology as men, then I would say, then I am being sexist. But those other things aren't true, so therefore I think that statement is misguided.
How much of this is motivated by a moral case or by a social justice or fairness ideal? And how much of it has to do with the business case behind it? How much of it is capitalist?
I will absolutely admit that there is a kind of a moral or social justice part of it. Having said that, there is a good business case. I do consider myself, for the most part, a bit of a contrarian investor. And I do truly believe that products, particularly consumer products, created by both women and men end up being much better products. I think that's just a fact.
Did I read somewhere that you were in food and beverage type biz at some point?
Sort of, yeah. On the side, I have invested in real estate here locally in Seattle. And sometimes there is a restaurant or bar component to that real estate. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, is it a lot different around, you know, women in leadership in, say, bars and restaurants than it is in tech?
Well, here's what they have in common. In fact, I actually used to always say that if you created a place, a restaurant or a bar for guys, only the guys would show up. If you created it for women, then women and men show up.
Well, it seems like when we're thinking about how to close this disparity, it seems like a lot of the conversation at times focuses on how women, again, pushing women to be more assertive or something like that. And I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns about that. because I don't think the conversation should be how should women change. I think the conversation should change to how should men change, or how should the framework change, that there could be different styles and methods of communication, and we need to be really great listeners.
So it's been a year now, almost exactly a year, actually, since you made that announcement at the conference. How's it gone? Have you stuck to your guns?
I have stuck to my guns, and it's still a year is still too early to tell how your investments have panned out. But since then, I've invested in Glamhive, GiftStarter, Runway to Street, Poppy, Scout, and there are a couple of others that are pending.
And how many of those companies that you listed have a female founder?
Oh, all of them. All of them.
Well, Jonathan Spazzato is an angel investor here in Seattle, and he's the backer of companies including PicMonkey and Glamhive and a bunch of other things. He's also the chairman of GeekWire. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Hey, thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is startups. And the guy we're going to meet next always had an entrepreneurial streak. As a young kid, K.Y. King Garrett started a car wash business, and in high school he launched a clothing line. And he credits some important role models in business, especially his grandfather.
He was actually the first black electrical engineer in the Northwest, so that's his kind of, I guess, his tech background. And you know, later in his life, he was one of the co-founders of Liberty Bank, which was the first black bank west of the Mississippi, and it was created to give African-American and other communities who did not have access to capital, whether for businesses or for, you know, home loans or home improvement, access to the capital.
Liberty Bank was located on 24th and Union in Seattle's Central District. And today, just a block away, sits Garrett's latest venture, Black Dot. Black Dot is a startup hub geared toward connecting black entrepreneurs with support and resources. They link people up with mentors, networking opportunities, and a space to work. Garrett is one of four founders of Black Dot. He sat down with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson to talk about why it's so important to make sure people of color are not left out of Seattle's tech boom.
Small business and entrepreneurship are the lifeblood of a community. And we have African-American community here in Seattle and many other communities which are being displaced, been vulnerable based on years of systematic kind of underdevelopment. And now that there are other economies that are growing, such as the tech economy here and in other places, because the community has not participated in the growth, it's being displaced by the growth. And so it was important to have a space that was dedicated to strengthening small business and providing resources, skills, knowledge, and network opportunities for established and aspiring entrepreneurs to launch and grow their ventures. Black Dot is really about building a startup ecosystem, you know, in the black community, which has been disconnected or not been a part of the larger startup ecosystem. So I think Black Dot is critical as being an epicenter or a nexus, a center of gravity where many different minds and people can bring their gifts and they mix and new things are created and, you know, birthed into the community.
How did Black Dot emerge? I mean, what's its origin story?
So Black Dot grew out of the work of Hack the CD. The hackathon is over, you know, weekend, 54-hour period. You build out a venture, a business model, prototype, you know, and it's like a pitch contest or whatever. And so there were many projects that came out of that where the entrepreneurs or the innovators wanted to continue to go forward, and they needed both community and additional, you know, support and resources as well as a central space. And so that is kind of what gave birth to the Black Dot co-working space.
And what sort of entrepreneurs have you seen prosper here at Black Dot?
Well, we're in our first 6 months, so a couple of examples that come to mind are the Seattle Filmmakers of African Diaspora group, which formed here at Black Dot, and there's been a variety of collaborations and opportunities that group continues to meet regularly. There was also a kind of a dispersed or fragmented network of people who were involved in food justice that, you know, were having various challenges in terms of some were urban farmers, some were community-based organizations, some were culinary professionals. And so we were able to create an opportunity to form a Black Farmers Food Justice Food Sovereignty Collective. And that group came together and actually was able to secure land in the Yesler Terrace to have a sizable urban farm.
And why is it important for you to stay here specifically? Why not, you know, move to a new community?
Well, I don't know how people just move to a new community, but it's all about preservation and development and growing the seeds that have been planted by previous generations, building on the accomplishments. I mean, that's how all communities or societies, you know, move forward, is by each generation taking it further. You look at, say, like a Nordstrom's, each generation of the family added on, and not only within Seattle, but, you know, took it to national or multinational enterprise. And so those same type of opportunities, which have been kind of restricted historically in certain communities, we want to make sure that everyone is able to participate in the opportunity and prosperity of the future that the city and many leaders speak about as far as equitable development and shared prosperity. And so we think Black Dot is a critical opportunity to move things in that direction. A big part of Black Dot is not bringing innovation to the community, but understanding that there's a legacy of innovation in this community. When you think about, you know, what Jimi Hendrix did with the guitar, and, you know, Quincy Jones being here, and many other, you know, examples of innovative entrepreneurial spirit, but it's disconnected from the current, you know, innovation economy or the tech, you know, sectors.
What personally motivates you to keep doing this work, to be a community organizer? I mean, I'm someone who's moved a lot. I don't really have a community. You've lived here your whole life. You feel, it seems like you're so invested in this place. What keeps you doing that work?
Well, I'm a product of community, for one, and I have children, and, you know, their environment is going to influence them. So I think it's important to, you know, do all that can be done to create the world that we want to live in, create a world that the next generation can flourish and be their best selves in. I guess there's a saying that, you know, service is the rent we pay. And so nothing, you know, that comes to us is a product of us alone. And so it's just, you know, as it was given, you know, so can we give. And we just keep, you know, passing it on and striving to make a contribution that makes things better.
K.Y. King Garrett is co-founder of Black Dot, a startup hub in the Central District in Seattle. He talked with Sound Effect's Ali Ferguson. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and as we talk today about startups, we're going to finish up with a pioneering entrepreneur in the music business. Bonnie Buckingham, better known as Bonnie Guitar, had her first big hit in 1957. The next year, she founded a record label in Seattle. That was something really unusual for a woman here in the 50s. She went on to produce bands that became Northwest music legends. She kept on making her own music and flirting with more fame over the decades, but just as impressive as her musical output and her innovations on the business side is the fact that Bonnie Guitar is still playing. She's 93 years old, and she still does a weekly gig at a club in Soap Lake, Washington, where she lives.
Hello.
Come in.
Hi.
Bonnie Guitar may not get around as easily as she once did, but her eyes are bright, her singing voice is intact, and her passion for music and innovation still bubbled just under the surface.
Could you tell me about when you first picked up the guitar?
I was about 12 years old, but my brothers, I had older brothers, and they both played guitar, so I could not play it. Finally, they allowed me to tune it, and once I could tune it better than they could, nobody got it away from me.
Was there a time when you were a child when you first knew that you weren't just good at playing guitar, but that this could be your life?
I knew that. when I was about 12 or maybe less than 12. I lived on a farm. We had a lot of trees, and I used to climb trees and pretend I was broadcasting. And I had my eye on the business from the time I was old enough to think about it. At school, they wouldn't let me play guitar because they said it was a hillbilly instrument, and it was absolutely ignored. They didn't consider it to be an instrument that should be played in a band.
Away up high up in the sky, oh tell me why, oh tell me why you've lost your splendor.
So not having a lot of female role models, how did it even occur to you that this was something that you could do?
You know, I think I never thought of it. I just assumed that I knew how to do it, and I was learning more all the time, so I didn't question it.
Did you have to prove yourself to a lot of people?
Oh, my. Many. Every day, really. I remember the time a lady came to my place and asked me to do some demo records for her. And I said to her, "Who's going to hear this?" And she said, "Well, I have a record label in Malibu, California, and they're waiting to hear my songs." Well, that was opening a door for me. So I did all the songs that she gave me. She sent them to Hollywood, and when he heard them, and he asked me to come to Malibu and audition for his studio. So my mom and I went down to Malibu, and I played guitar and sang for him. He immediately signed me with a record contract and made me a studio musician.
That was an important period for you, right, being a studio musician, because you got you an inside glimpse of what the studio system was like.
Oh, those were such good times, those years that I played in the studio. I got to be exposed to the kind of music I wanted to hear.
I'm living in two worlds, dividing my time.
How did you get the idea to start your own music label, your own studio?
I was associated with a fellow named Bob Reisdorf at the time, and he was a record promoter. We used to talk this business all the time, talk the business, and he was in Olympia, and he talked with the Fleetwoods, and they said, "Do you know Bonnie Guitar?" And he said, "Yes," and they said, "Well, will you give her this tape so that she can listen to us?" And I immediately knew that those kids could have a hit record. That turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me.
So how did you even go about setting up Dolphin Records? I guess it was Dolphin Records first, right? And you and Bob Reinsdorf launched that label together in Seattle.
I had spent so much time in Hollywood with Faber Robinson and his label at Malibu. I had been learning then because he was teaching me when he had artists come in the studio, instead of me playing guitar, he had me as his assistant. So while I'm in there being assistant, I'm learning everything I'm supposed to do. I'm learning the equipment. I realized that I could do that.
So I'd like to ask you about another band that you brought in after the Fleetwoods and their big success. You discovered another band, an instrumental band out of Tacoma, The Ventures, who are still one of the most famous bands in the Northwest.
They are. They came to our label, and that was something that was wonderful for us to follow up the Fleetwoods with someone like The Ventures, you know.
What do you like about recognizing talent, about finding undiscovered talent?
That's the most fun of all. Right now I'm working with a young fellow here in the Soap Lake area, lives two blocks down. Magnificent talent that you'd never hear. He writes his own material, he's a singer. When I hear that, it's like eating a good steak. I can't wait till I can get my hands on somebody to work with like that, you know. How could you not want to do something for that artist?
So I know you said you savor the quiet life that you have now and that you don't really need the glitz anymore. But as you kind of think back on the days of your fame, I mean, you tasted some real fame on national TV and on the Opry and on all these different places. What's a memory that you have that makes you smile?
All of those things were great. I did the Sullivan Show and the Dick Clark Show, and all those shows were great. I want to tell you this without reservation. This is the truth, if I've ever spoken it. I had some negative things, too, of course, but I had the most wonderful life in this business anyone could ever have, and that, if I think about that, that's a smiling thing. And now, the way life is now is wonderful, too, because although I'm not getting around very well, I still get to play on Saturday nights, and when you think about it, it can't be anything but a smile, I guess.
When you look at something like hearing tape of yourself from 50 years ago and stuff like that, do you still feel like the same person? Do you still feel connected to the young Bonnie Guitar who was out there making hits?
I do, in a way. I wish that I were more connected with the voice I had then, because as years go by, you lose your voice. So I tell you the truth, I get a little bit upset when I hear how I did them in those days, and I can't do them that way in those days because my range is too limited now. Pack up all my cares and woes, here I go, singing low, bye, bye, blackbird.
How have you managed to keep the dexterity in your fingers and your hands to play?
Well, I did, but just recently, somehow, I just woke up one morning and my hand was swollen. Well, I haven't been able to play the guitar since that. So now in the band, I just sing, and I can't play the things like Mr. Fire Eyes and Riders in the Sky and those up-tempo things. So I'm being limited right now, and I probably have another 2 months before I'll be able to play at all.
Have you gone this long without playing guitar before?
Never, never, never. I couldn't. I have a guitar right by my side all the time right now, and I've had a guitar with me when I was in a hospital once. You get as close to that guitar as you do a person, almost. What we feel as musicians, that our instruments have soul, that they have a life of their own. And believe me, guitars are more so than anyone. And if I couldn't play it, I'd take it with me anyway.
Are you sad about not being able to play right now?
I am. I have that. I'd like to tell you no, but I tell you the truth. I hear things and I want to play that. And I want to play that so badly. And that makes me sad. However, I feel very happy about the fact that I have a future where I can look ahead and think that maybe in a couple of months or 3 months I'll be able to play.
Well, Bonnie Guitar, a resident of Soap Lake and longtime pioneer in music and production, business, and pretty much the whole spectrum, thank you so much for talking with me.
Gabriel, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much.
Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson, with help this week from Warren Langford, Bree Ripley, and our intern, Jenny Palmer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive guru for content ideation. Send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or find us on Facebook. And time is running out for you to get your tickets to see Sound Effect live on May 18th with author Tom Robbins, singer Kimya Dawson, writer Melanie McFarland, photographer Tim Durkin, and Skerrick's Bandelabra. The money goes to Save KPLU. You can find out more at kplu.org. Come on back next week for stories of that other thing I do.
A couple weeks later, I got a call, and they said, "Do you want to go?" I had no designs on being a professional clown.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.